from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us and clicking the subscribe button. This is episode number 41, recorded on Wednesday, March 11th. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen. And joining me, QE was his nickname in high school. Back then, QE stood for quick and easy. Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great. Yeah, it's not so easy anymore these days.
Not so easy. Yeah, I think it was because you were such a good chef, right? And you prepared food very rapidly, something like that, you know?
Yeah, I just put something on the bread and that was my secret recipe for eating fast and easy.
From the quick and easy kitchen, yeah, so that's good. And this week, QE, we'll talk about quantitative easing because this program is just launched by ECB this week, so we'll commemorate this historic event by talking about QE, all the ins and outs, what have yous, and sideways. And let's start with what exactly is it?
Well, as I see it, and of course there are many interpretations, when central banks exhaust the interest rate cuts, when it reaches around zero, they try to lower the long-term interest rates by buying bonds, government bonds, and can be sometimes mortgage-based securities or corporate bonds. This way they lower the long-term interest rates and help lending and help providing confidence in times of trouble. How would you define it?
I think basically when interest rates are so low and the bank has nowhere to go because it tries to stimulate the economy, try to make people spend more money, lowering interest rate just doesn't work. So you have to use any a little bit more radical choices and radical programs. One of them is the whole quantitative easing, in which they actually try to lend more money to banks and thus spread the wealth, if you will, so people will have a little bit more money, they spend it, and thus start to raise inflation again and stimulate the economy. Especially now when inflation is so low across Europe, Japan, US, so central banks are scrambling around and trying to raise inflation in order to bring it up to their targets. For ECB, for instance, the target is 2%. Up until now, I think, they came a little bit short, so to speak.
Yeah, we're in a deflation territory now in Europe. For the ECB, it's 2% headline inflation. The Fed has sort of a target of 2% in core inflation, but it also has an employment mandate.
And okay, so we talked about the haves and the what is it. So now, who actually use it? So I, of course, alluded to the fact that the FOMC has been implementing it since 2008. They have used with the Q1, 2, 3, and they had all those nicknames. ECB just launched a very huge QE program of 1.1 trillion euros, right?
Yeah, although it might change, in theory, they might continue beyond September 2016. That means it'll be even larger. They're basically buying European government bonds and other assets at a pace of 60 billion euros per month.
Oh, okay. And Japan have been trying to get out of the lost decade, which now has been, the last two decades,
yeah,
with the whole Ebonomics. So what has transpired in Japan, and how do you think they've been going at it since then?
Well, in the 80s, it seems that Japan Inc., Japan Incorporated, was taking over the world, buying everything. They were doing really great, and they also had a housing boom. Sounds familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, then they had a bust in somewhere in the 90s, and they tried to stimulate their economy by cutting interest rates. Eventually, they entered deflation and tried quantitative easing. Didn't work out so well. I think only now, in early 2013, with Abe coming into power as prime minister and his nomination of Kuroda, as a governor of the Bank of Japan, they did a much larger program, enlarged it again in late 2014. I think it's around 80 trillion yen or so. Anyway, they're buying bonds at a much faster pace.
And for them, they had a little bit more problems that other countries didn't face, such as the whole terrible tsunami that they had in 2011 that obviously had devastating ramifications ramifications on their economy. This also brings to mind, and we'll tackle it a little bit further down the line, but does QE program actually work? Does it actually benefit the economy? Does it set out to do what it's supposed to do? But before we'll tackle that, let's circle around. Also, another country that is big on QE, it's Great Britain.
Yeah, so they also entered the game relatively early. They cut interest rates quite fast. In fact, it's already 6 years since their interest rate is at 0.5% without any change. And their quantitative easing program is worth £375 billion. It began at a more modest scale and was enlarged over time. I think last enlargement was in 2012.
If anything, they're supposed to start winding down, right? Just like the US has done it past year or so.
Well, they're like in the US, they're expected to first raise the interest rate and then at some point unwind QE. At the moment, they are continuing to reinvest proceeds from maturing bonds. That means maintaining their balance sheet at the same level. Who knows when it'll be unwound?
Yeah, and for now, if we look at, for instance, at one measurement as the GDP for this year, then the expectations are pretty good for the US and the UK. US supposed to rise by 3.6% to UK by 2.7%, while the European Union and Japan, their growth rate is supposed to be around 1.2% and 0.6% respectively. This also puts into a little bit question of whether or not they've implemented these programs in time and whether or not they are actually effective. When it comes to the ECB, they have just recently started, as you said, this whole QE program. Do you think that this kind of program be enough for the European Union to actually start jumpstart their economy?
Yes, for a few reasons. The main benefit for the Eurozone in QE is just a weaker euro. The euro was too strong, maybe adequate for Germany, but too strong for the rest. And I think a weaker euro against the US dollar, against the Chinese yuan, against the British pound, Swiss franc, all their main trading partners, huge countries in the world, of course, this will help exports, this will lift inflation. So I think the main benefit is via the exchange rate. In addition, there are other factors that help the Eurozone. It's just that unemployment has reached high levels above 11% that I think things can only get better. They've reached some kind of bottom in the Eurozone. In addition, they already front-loaded quite a lot of austerity, and now there's talk, hopefully, that they'll end austerity. So I think compounded with at least some kind of minimal fiscal stimulus, it can also help. But the main contribution of QE to the Eurozone economy, to growth, and employment, and inflation is via the exchange rate.
Okay, so you already opened that door, so let's talk about it. So what's the actual potential ramifications of a QE program? Let's start with the currency. So it's supposed to reduce, depreciate the local currency, but is that the case for all the countries that actually implemented it? Let's start with Japan. With Japan, I think it's pretty straightforward. The answer is pretty much yes, right? They have devalued their currency in the past several years. It was what, around 80, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, 80? Under 80.
Under 80, 80 for the US dollar and Japanese yen, and now it's around 121. Sorry. And if they'll actually go forward, and as you said in a previous episode, maybe they'll introduce another QE program in April, then maybe they'll continue with this progress and the Japanese will further depreciate. But this brings us to the US dollar. Do you think it had an adverse impact on its currency?
Well, the first program certainly had, because the US dollar was strengthening in the wake of the financial crisis. It was shooting higher. So the US dollar began depreciating and it reached fresh lows during the early years after the financial crisis broke out.
Yeah, because everybody were scrambling around and said, oh, all right, you know, let's go to the almighty dollar in these dire times and just invest no matter what.
Yeah, it was a funding currency. Also, it was just with all those dollars printed around that the Fed's programs were the largest in the world. So that weakened the US dollar. It's also important to remember that ECB QE is just, from March 2015 in the air and in talking, well, just a few months beforehand. So the euro was sort of losing out in the currency wars by just not participating. And Japan until late 2012, early 2013 was not really involved. I mean, it had QE for a very long time, but it wasn't significant enough. So British pound did weaken. Of course, it was very weak early in the financial crisis thanks to the QE program, but it doesn't have such a global effect like the US dollar had. The weakening of the US dollar error that was the result of the massive QE programs.
Yeah, and obviously one of their goals was to also have an impact on yields and interest rates and long-term interest rates. And in effect, even though they've implemented all these QE programs, which were supposed to bring a little bit of pressure on the yields. And this also brings to mind that we had two plays in hand, that on the one hand, you had the Fed trying to impact long-term interest rates and bring them down. But on the other hand, people continue to buy long-term treasury bonds and bringing further down yields.
Yeah, I think it was sort of they were playing with each other. Everybody rushed to buy yields as safe haven assets, or because the Fed was buying them and the Fed was buying them in order to lower them. So we had a depressing effect on bond yields and long-term interest rates.
Yeah, and even now when everybody, well, up until a few this week, the last couple of weeks or so, but at the beginning of the year in 2015, even though people expected that interest rates will go up, which is supposed to also raise long-term yields eventually, assuming rational expectations and all that, what have you, still interest rates, long-term yields continued to come down. Only in the last couple of few weeks or so, they've started to rise again. They're still pretty low. I mean, 10-year yields are still around 2.3%.
Yeah, there are a few explanations for that. First is that while QE has ended in October, it doesn't mean that the balance sheet of the Fed began shrinking. It just doesn't, it stopped growing. It's being maintained at $4.5 trillion. It means every bond that matures, for every bond that matures, the Fed buys another one and keeps its foot on the pedal.
Yeah, to keep the balance sheet intact and with the same kind of ratio between long-term and short-term debt.
Yeah, so even though short-term interest rates are set to rise, long-term interest rates are still depressed. Another factor is that, up to very recently, and maybe probably still, the markets just won't believe it until it happens, that interest rates are going to go up in the US after so many years of basically zero rates. And the third factor is the ECB's QE. It's, you can look at it as the Fed passing the baton to the ECB, which is also, of course, controls huge economy and, well, second economy in the world. If you look not at countries but at
GDP.
Yeah, GDP. With the ECB's QE already in expectations depressing Eurozone bond yields, US bond yields are considered safe and they provide a much higher yield. So this attracts flows from the Eurozone to the US and to specifically to bonds. So the dollar is strengthening and US bond yields are still shooting higher.
Yeah, and this brings us talking about the yields. We also have to talk about a little bit about debt. People are supposed to take on a little bit more debt because interest rates are very low and the banks get a little bit more money, so they're supposed to spread their wealth. In effect, what we saw that the debt level hasn't gone up, or at least for households, they tried actually to bring their debt burden down. And this happens because after such a financial collapse of 2008, we saw that people had huge debts, asset prices went way down. Thus, people tried, as everybody, when you have high debt, you don't try to take another mortgage on your house, you try to pay off the first one.
Yeah, deleveraging.
Yeah, exactly. And this has happened also for companies, also for individuals. And this is why QE, maybe even though it's supposed to have some positive impact on people taking a little bit more debt, but in effect, it's a little bit more questionable. This also brings us to housing. So housing, they were supposed to have also an impact from the QE program, stimulate the housing market. What do you think?
Well, I think, as you said, I mean, debt was the problem that brought the US down in the first place. So I think in a way, the Fed, I mean, lowered interest rates when it already the horses had already left the stable. It was perhaps they should have cool down the housing market well in advance in the early 2000s, and then we would have less debt, less recession, and when interest rates would have gone down, people would actually be credit worthy to take these loans. But that's very hypothetical. In general, well, QE, I think, does solve the problem of supply. I mean, taking loans is much easier. But demand, that's a whole different problem. And I think for demand, this is where the role of governments comes in at times of trouble.
All right. And lastly, about commodities. We cannot talk about QE without a little bit commodities. Where I see it, talk about commodities and QE, for me, it's the go-to is obviously gold and silver, mainly gold. With all the gold bugs are pretty adamant saying, oh, this is going to be the apocalypse. Supposed to start stocking up on gold. Peter Schiff is one of the main vocals, talk pretty profusely about it's the doomsday device kind of thing. Maybe not such hyperbolic, but you get the picture. This calls into question, is it actually such a prudent idea to invest in gold if you actually believe that inflation will erupt pretty soon? What do you think?
Well, we talked about this in depth in a previous episode. In general, we know hindsight that after gold reached a peak of almost $2,000 back in 2011, prices have fallen and we haven't seen real bounces. In general, inflation is just not here, and needless to say, no hyperinflation. Hyperinflation is also related to a war or another big political event, and so far we've seen stability. So far gold doesn't provide any cure or any hedge against inflation.
Not to mention it's so volatile, and there have been times back in the 80s where inflation, at the early 80s, if you recall, when the inflation, I think you were three at the time, so you obviously remember that, and the inflation soared and the yields have gone sharply up afterwards because the Fed tried to sustain the inflation. But back then gold rose pretty sharply and soon after tumbled down after the Fed implemented, and thus if you actually invested in gold during the peak, then you would have lost a lot more than if you would have just invested in long-term yields, and it would have been a much safer bet for you. So not for nothing, if you actually think that there is going to be inflation down the line, then maybe there are other ways to invest, such as in as I said, in treasury bonds. That's that's one way to go.
Regarding commodities, I think that in the wake of the financial crisis, we had the huge stimulus from the US QE programs and also Japan and the UK at a lesser extent on the global scale. And we also had huge stimulus from China. Both these factors fueled commodity prices. So I wouldn't say that QE alone is responsible for the higher commodity prices in the wake of the financial crisis. And I don't think that the recent fall in commodity prices is just because of the end of QE in the United States. So QE in general is just one factor, I think an important one, a stimulative one, but it cannot work on its own and isn't responsible on its own for every move in the markets.
All right, so speaking of all the impacts, so does it actually work? That's the $64,000 question. So does it have any merit?
Well, it's in the trillions, not in the $64,000.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, as I said, it depends on other factors. For instance, in Japan, there just wasn't enough of it for many, many years. Japan began its QE programs before the financial crisis of 2008. Another problem that Japan has is shrinking demographics. If you have more money available for the public, but the public is shrinking, it doesn't really help growth. In the United States, it did work, I think, because it was compounded with a huge stimulus program from the government and a program to stabilize the banks. Of course, that's both things are controversial. Should have banks been saved, yes or no, or what's the role of government? These are political issues, of course. But basically, the U.S. acted with fiscal and monetary stimulus, and it did stabilize the system. The U.S. is growing for nearly 6 years. And in Europe, I think it will work because of the huge impact we're already seeing on the exchange rate, and because of the bottom I think that Europe has reached. I mean, it just, I don't think it can get much worse in so many countries in the Eurozone, such as Spain, Italy, France. So maybe Germany will suffer a bit of inflation down the road in 2016, above average. But in general, it's I think QE is a very positive thing for the Eurozone. What do you think?
You know, I'm pretty torn on this QE program, because let me tell you why. Because on the one hand, you have the doves, the traditional doves, Bernanke, Summers, Krugman. They all think that it is very effective, and when traditional traditional policy tools don't work. Not for nothing, Krugman also, as you said, also said it's more effective if you actually introduce also fiscal policy, fiscal stimulus along with it, and maybe even raising the inflation target and to be a little bit more reckless for the Fed. So when people consider that there is a possibility of higher inflation down the line, then maybe they'll spend a little bit more money and take a little bit more debt, because high inflation means that down the line they'll have to pay less in real term.
Yeah, there were talks about targeting nominal GDP rather than allowing 5% nominal GDP, even if it includes a high inflation component, is positive.
When I'm looking at a little bit more of a realistic perspective, I don't know if that actually also work if you raise the inflation target. I mean, I get it if it's over 10%, like it's in Argentina. People actually do change their behavior because they know, oh, I'll take when I buy in the supermarket, I buy groceries, I'll take it a 10-month loan. If they do it without the interest rate, why not? Because when I'll pay it in 5 months now, from 6 months from now, the payments will be so much lower than what they are now. But if it's a rise from 1% to 3% or 2% to 4%, I don't know how much you and I or other people actually do change our behavior when it comes to debt. That's number one. Number two, there's also the whole, let's put it, the ultra doves or anti-doves. I don't know how you put it.
Hawks.
Yeah, not the hawks. There's the base of Richard Koo, that he thinks that QE doesn't work and you only have to use fiscal stimulus. He's not opposed to it. He just says that it doesn't work, because if you are in a state where you're in a balance sheet recession that occurs when the private sector has a lot of debt and is focusing not on maximizing their profits, is what it's supposed to do, but actually in paying down their debt and deleveraging. In these cases, QE won't work. And if you look at the chart that we've put up on the website, you can look that the money base since 2008 has gone up by 450%. So it's gone 4.5 times over the past 7 years or so, because as we know, QE was implemented. But when you look at the loan and leases of all of the old banks, or to all commercial banks, then it has gone up over these 7 years only by 19%.
So where's the money?
So yeah, as we know, banks are sitting on it. That's why when you look at the multiplier, it has gone, the M1 multiplier, you see that it's gone down by 50% over those 7 years. This is why, this chart is actually why Richard Koo is trying to persuade us that, QE, it's not such a great thing. He's not opposed it necessarily, but maybe it's not that effective of a tool as much as just increasing the government spending. And this is where I'm torn, because I look at these figures and I think that on the one hand, I think that QE does have its merits, because the US economy has gone out of its recession more or less. The UK has done pretty well. Japan, okay, that's a little bit more complex in that case.
Yeah, in the UK, despite having a conservative government that vote to lower the deficit, the reality is that they haven't undergone real austerity. So also in the UK, it's a similar case to the US, where there has been also fiscal stimulus in addition to monetary stimulus.
Yeah, so that's my point, and it's because we don't have so many instances in our history where we had such a situation to actually analyze it and see what happened if you just implement QE or just implement fiscal stimulus and compare and contrast. So it's a little bit more of a hunch whether or not it works. For now, it seems that it doesn't do any bad thing, and it does have a little bit, even if to the margins, it does have a little bit of a positive impact on the economy. I agree with you, if you don't actually put into play also the government spending, at least until the private sector start to rebalance itself and start to taking on a little bit more debt. And for now, companies that don't do that, what they have been doing is just buying back their shares and cutting down debt
and trying to lower their tax payments.
Yeah,
all kinds of financial tricks and not anything related to the real economy.
Not actually related to investing and actually trying to create more jobs, more growth, more of these kind of things. I mean, McDonald's last year implemented a $17 billion buyback of shares, Apple $30 billion. So that's where the companies are putting their money to work.
Yeah, even Apple, which does make real products and is the world's most valued company, and a lot of their revenue comes from, selling bonds in the markets, even though they're sitting on a huge pile of cash. And, well, Yahoo is also a good example. Not the best tech company at the moment, but one of their biggest tricks of late was just to find some very interesting way to not to pay tax on their shares of this Chinese giant.
Yeah, Alibaba.
Alibaba, yeah. And they even called one of the instruments there, this holdings company, they called it SpinCo. Because it's a spin.
Oh, and that's genius.
Markets loved it.
Wow, so, yeah, that's... Marissa Meyer, she knows what she's doing, yeah.
Yeah.
So this brings us... So let's play a little bit the devil's advocate. So what are the perils of using QE? Yohai?
Well, we talked about reckless inflation. It can be good when things are really bad. The smarter thing is to know in better times when to cut down, when to curb demand in order to prevent another bubble and another recession. Boom and the consequent bust. So the big question is, will the Fed, Bank of England, Japan, and the ECB know how and when to begin scaling this back in order not to create new bubbles? Or perhaps we already have bubbles. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think everybody, when they talk about QE and the government and the central bank being reckless, they talk, they also refer, in a sense, to countries such as Argentina that, the country hasn't done well. They have double-digit inflation, high levels of debt, devalued currency, capital flight, the economy is contracting, maybe this year they actually start to grow again. So, yeah, they have what you call an overheated economy, where inflation is pretty high. What the bank actually supposed to do is raise rates, and the government isn't supposed to print more money, and that's what they do in order to finance their debt. So that's a way economies go astray, and this is not what you want.
Yeah, but Argentina is not such a mature democracy like the United States or European countries or Japan or the UK. They did over privatization in the 90s, and recently they did some nationalization. So economic policy in general in Argentina, or policy in general, is quite erratic, and that's part of the hyperinflation story, or inflation if you wish.
But they make great steaks, you cannot deny that.
Yeah, good wine, chocolate, especially steaks, yeah,
so they are pretty awesome in that. So the last question, so getting out of it, this is okay, it's all fun and play until you actually have to start reducing your $4.5 trillion balance sheet or something.
Yeah, and the ECB is set to reach 3 trillion in total from its current balance sheet. And the Bank of England, well, it's only in the billions, but it's still a lot of money.
Only
and,
billions. So amateurs.
Anyway, when you begin not buying new bonds for everyone that matures, just letting it fade out, you have a rise in long-term interest rates, and that might hurt the economy. Or if it's done correctly, prevent overheating. But how do you find the right balance? It's also uncharted territory of unwinding QE.
Yeah, it's a pretty big question what will happen, because we didn't have so many economies buying of debt, and now they have to start to reduce their balance sheet. Eventually, I don't know when they'll actually start to implement it, but they could cause another economic recession or pop another bubble in the housing market. These are all because for the Fed, for instance, they've bought also a lot of mortgage-backed securities. So we don't know if this will have any direct or indirect impact on the housing market as well when they'll actually start to deleveraging themselves and cutting down the balance sheet. This is a big question as well, and this is why a lot of people also a little bit fear that this could have some adverse ramifications on the economy, depending on how it will be implemented.
Yeah, I can say only one thing for certain. When central banks begin unwinding QE, we'll have even more volatility than now. That's good for traders.
So good for your traffic. That's basically what you're saying.
Yeah. Come visit Forex Crunch and the trading energy. It will be a lot of fun when that happens.
Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of excitement. Okay, that's it. That's our show for this week. Thank you, as usual, Yochai.
Thank you, Lior.
Thank Thank you all for listening. If you like our show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or subscribe to the show via Stitcher, email, RSS, or iTunes, whatever suits you fancy. So until next week, this is Lior signing off for Yochai, saying have a great week and best responsibly.
This podcast should be used for educational, research, and informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. There are no guarantees expressed or implied of future positive returns in regard to the subject matter contained herein. Understand the risks inherent in investing before making the decision to invest or consult an investment professional for more information. Reasonable due diligence has been performed in regards to the information in this podcast. However, the hosts and guests of this podcast expressly disclaim any liability for accidental omissions of information or errors in fact. For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.